Succession number 28417, reel number 1.
So, John, thank you very much for agreeing to contribute to the Imperial War Museum Sound Archive, which is much appreciated. Can we start...
It's an honour.
Well, it's extremely kind of you to suggest that. Can we start with your full name and date of birth, please?
John Henry Harvey Jones, with a hyphen. I was born on the 16th of April, 1924. In that most romantic of settings, Hackney.
And can you tell me something about your family?
I always find it rather difficult to describe my father and mother. My father had been an Indian Army officer. He married my mother, and my mother found the heat in India very innovating. He took early retirement after the First War, and he then was totally a fish out of water. He tried selling insurance, as many did, and was no good at it. He was, in fact, no salesman at all. He was an absolutely archetypal, successful army officer of his day. He got the Sword of Honour at Wellington, and he was a rugby player. He shot everything that blinked, rode horses, stuck pigs, shot tigers, you know, everything that I am not. He then took a job as a professional prime minister and guardian of underage Maharajas, and he would bring them up as a son, but also minister of state for them. But he was a freelance, he was not a government employee, although of course he had to be approved by the government. So I spent my first 5 years really in the height of luxury as a sort of a white and therefore superior brother of a small black Maharaja. And indeed, on my fifth birthday, I remember it well. The state band came and played outside my room, which was in a palace anyway. Personal elephant was paraded and slammed to me. And on my sixth birthday, I was in England having the hell beaten out of me and a brutal and, I think, slightly unpleasant English prep school, head teacher was the founder member of the Deal State of Masochist Club, and even by the standard of the day, wielded the cane rather more than was normal.
Just before we go on to prep school, what state in India were you in?
Well, I lived in Dhamba. I was brought up with the Maharaja of Dhar, D-H-A-R, and he was educated at the Prince's College in Indore, the Daily College.
So you had 6 years in India before you...
Yes.
Before you went...
Yeah. Which, of course, was a bad preparation for immersion into England, because I was a total oddball. Because, of course, I didn't live anywhere. I didn't have a home in England. If I did try to explain what my father did, I got beaten up. And I didn't fit and didn't have any points of relevance at all.
Do you think the experience marked you? Or did you survive it?
Oh, it was horrendous. It was probably still the most unhappy period of my life. I was desperately lonely. It did some good things for me. I took refuge in books, and I read voraciously. And, of course, I found my refuge in imagination. I was, of course, forced to play games of which I was abysmal, and managed to fail practically everything I was forced to do. The only things I enjoyed doing were I enjoyed swimming, and I enjoyed shooting, and subsequently, when I joined the Navy, I loved sailing. First choice.
The Navy was not your first choice.
No. My first choice was, and God knows why, I formed the wish to become a lawyer. And my mother at the same time, rather in a rather unlikely fashion, through friends, had decided I should study chemical engineering, which was a bloody good idea, actually, but again, because I was not particularly practical and didn't seem... didn't really fire me. Because of my reading and because at that time all the boys' books were adventure book stories about the Navy, after my father was dead, he couldn't afford me to become a lawyer, and I got back where I earned my living earlier than that, which was quite wise on his part. I found that rarely I could in theory support myself from the age of about 16, if I got into Dartmouth. So I swatted for Dartmouth and passed in reasonably well. And Dartmouth, where the discipline in those days was absolutely draconian, was sort of emerged into paradise from my prep school, because although the discipline was very strong, it was absolutely fair, and my prep school was a hive of bullying and run very largely by 10-year-old boys, with an occasional violent intervention by the headmaster. I passed into Dartmouth and joined there in, wait a minute, let me think, 37, I think it was. Yes, either 36 or 37. And of course, then went through the usual training there. I mean, I suppose I am rude about Dartmouth, but Dartmouth was an entirely purpose-designed education. It was not really an education at all. You were only taught things that were useful to you, or deemed to be useful to you in your future career as a naval officer. So, for example, I mean, I can still, and if you wish me to do so, we'll do so, draw the position of all the ships at Nelson ships at the Battle of the Nile. But the Industrial Revolution was passed over, as I remember, about a hot morning's hour. And again, you know, we were taught a spherical trigonometry, which is of no use to you outside navigation and isn't much use in that now. But we were not really taught calculus. So we were very specifically brought up, but wonderfully brought up, not to be an admiral, but to be cannon fodder for the Royal Navy. The aim of Dartmouth was to produce the highest possible level of failed lieutenant commander. And the assumption was that the odd admiral who, for some reason, had fallen amongst us riffraff would emerge. And indeed, the Navy went to great trouble to see if there were any burgeoning signs of anybody emerging. I was at Dartmouth, of course, when the war started in 1939. And my great chagrin was not immediately dispatched to sea. We were made, in those days, more or less complete our normal term. Not quite. We were a bit truncated, but not very much. In 1941, I passed out of Dartmouth, and I passed out. I had managed to do fairly well academically at Dartmouth. And while games prowess was an advantage, it was not a prerequisite. So my wetness for games wasn't in any way held against me. And of course the other great advantage of Dartmouth in those days was we did virtually a full engineering apprenticeship. Four hours a week. But during that, we did all the things a normal apprentice would have done, you know, filing, and I learned everything from casting, and but again, was not particularly practically gifted. I mean, if I filed, you know, in those days you filed a keyway and then had to file the edges. My keyway was always an undulating surface, and the edges never measured, and all the rest of it. But still, it was fun. I was selected to be an alpha, which was in the top two classes. One of which specialised in science and maths, which was obviously the better alpha to be in from the naval point of view. And the other was called rather wistfully the literary alpha, where you were taught languages, English, and in particular naval history. You were also allowed to do a lot of work on your own. You were allowed to work in the library at Dartmouth, which was good, incidentally. And you were very often given, you know, tasks or subjects to study and produce a thesis or whatever. So, again, although not strictly speaking, the stuff of greatness in the Navy were... The great thing was to be able to point a gun and actually hit something. It did teach one clarity of expression and to appreciate language. And I also, when I left Dartmouth, I spoke German and reasonable French.
Which you learned there?
Yes. The German proved to be useful. The French really, well, background, but not much more. I left Dartmouth, and we were allowed in those luxurious days to choose where we could be appointed, or the station we were appointed to. And I hadn't seen my father effectively since well before the war. He'd come over a couple of times with the Maharaja for the coronation and the jubilee, and I had been hauled out and basked in greatness. I still remember we had a large flat in Park Lane and lived, you know, the Rolls Royce life, of course, on this impoverished and pathetic Indian state. But I chose to go to the East Indies, thinking I'd have a chance to see my father. With the usual admiralty efficiency, of course, I was in fact appointed to a ship in the West Indies. And nobody apparently told the admiralty that there was a substantial distance between the two. So anyway, I and two other cadets, both of whom I had been in my term at Dartmouth, and one of whom is a lifelong friend, lives at Abergavenny, were dispatched with £10 in our pockets to join the Diomede, a light cruiser, which was allegedly in Bermuda. We worked our way across the Atlantic in a troop ship, where they largely, the RAF were who were accompanied by their wives or other people's wives, spent the Atlantic shagging like mad or night and day, when we used to have to keep watches and scramble across these recumbent or heaving bodies onto watch and off watch. But anyway, it was a good education, or rounded off some of the misty bits from Dartmouth. We arrived at Halifax, Nova Scotia, were transshipped to go to Bermuda, arrived at Bermuda to find our ship had sailed 2 days earlier and was headed for the Pacific. So we were then, still with what was less of our 10 quid in our pockets, shipped back to Halifax, given three railway tickets, and told to join our ship in Vancouver. We had a most wonderful trip across Canada by train, although we bloody near starved because we had no food and were still living on the remnants of our. And indeed, we discovered that the cheapest way to live in Canada was to buy 5 cent pieces of pie at railway buffets, and I couldn't face another piece of apple pie for about 10 years afterwards. We arrived eventually at Esquimalt on Vancouver Island, where to our great relief our ship arrived, and with it some relief financially as well, and we joined our first ship. I, by virtue of my academic record, was a senior midshipman. I was also the youngest midshipman, and we had a gunroom of six, which consisted of the three of us, all of whom were just on 17, and three Canadian midshipmen who were men of the world at 24. I was the senior above them, which gave me a valuable lesson. The Dami was really chasing, in those days, German raiders.
In the Pacific?
In the Pacific, yes. The primary one was commanded by a man who later became a great friend of mine, Admiral Roger. He was an admiral in those days. And they were armed merchant ships, Q-ships in a way, and they were causing absolute chaos with our shipping routes. And of course the Americans were not in the war then, so we had a hell of a time, because America being neutral, we were only allowed to enter an American port for under 24 hours. We had to be out within 24 hours, and we were not well treated at all. It was quite surprising. There was a tiny Anglophobe or Anglophile group in the San Francisco and that part of the world, but by and large they were pretty strongly pro-German, and we used to slink in and slink out. Our lives changed. We virtually never encountered anything. We never fired a shot that I can remember until the Americans entered the war, or rather the Japanese entered the war. And of course we suddenly found our status change from pariah to saviors. By that time we were all Panama, and we were summoned into Panama and put in charge of an American task force and told to invade the Galapagos Islands, which, such was the state of our intelligence, it was believed was stuffed with Japanese. We arrived and stormed ashore into the Galapagos, where a few rather subtle turtles greeted us. And there was yet another illustration of how absolutely, totally, pitifully unprepared we all were, really, for the sort of war we had. After that, the Diomede was shipped to go back to Bermuda, where we, as a ship, we were beginning to fall apart, and we reverted to our usual stuff of chasing raiders, and were sent down to the Falkland Islands, which was great fun. But on the way, our ship finally collapsed, or the engines collapsed, and we were we went into Montevideo and spent something like 8 weeks having to repair ourselves, which was just about possible. This was after the Battle of Plates, and so again we had a marvelous time there, but not particularly warlike. We then went for the first war, became a number of subsequent visits to the Falklands, because there was a German raider allegedly at work in the South Atlantic, which we again managed to avoid meeting, although we did pick up the odd survivors from sunken merchant ships and so on. We continued our non-war and were summoned to go back to Rosyth, pay off, and Dami was then completely rebuilt and re-equipped as an anti-aircraft cruiser. When we got to Rosyth, I was appointed to what was then in the old midshipman time, a destroyer time, and was lucky enough to be appointed to a ship called the Ithuriel, which was had damaged itself by ramming a submarine in the med and was just having a new bow put on in Portsmouth Harbour. We were nearing the end of being re-equipped, and so I was lucky enough to leave for the North African landings in Ithuriel, where again for the first time we began to see a bit of action. I was the only midshipman aboard there, which again was a very privileged and nice position, and you were much more of an officer there.
What sort of wardroom did you have on the Ithuriel?
On the Ithuriel, we had, I think, 8 or 9. We were commanded by a commander who was Maitland McGill Crichton, a good multiple-barreled name, who was commanded in turn by his mother, who virtually commanded the ship, who was a massive, formidable lady, who was almost an extra member of the order. Fortunately, when she wasn't able to accompany us to North Africa, well, it might have made a real difference if she had, but anyway. When we got to North Africa, we joined, first of all, the covering force that covered the landings, and there was a fair amount of banging guns and that sort of thing. We were, for the first time, facing a bit of air attack, so again we had something more like what one imagined the war in the Mediterranean to be. We were then moved up as a part of a force called Force Q, which was based on Bone, which was a forward harbour we owned at that time, or allegedly commanded. And the idea was to have 2 or 3 cruisers and 2 or 3 destroyers there, who would sortie out and interrupt and sink the supply convoys, which were supplying the Axis forces in North Africa.
And where was this harbour, Sir John?
Bone, B-O-N-E, in Algeria, on the Algerian-Tunisian border. Tunis was still held by the Axis. The first night we were in Bern, we were alongside, and we had a hell of an air raid, during the course of which I was on my gun, which was on the quarter deck. The guns were pretty useless because they would only elevate 45 degrees. The aircraft, of course, were immediately above us, but still, we made a lot of noise. But lo and behold, about 2 a.m., there was a bloody great bang, and two bombs blew the bottom out of the Ithuriel. Again, this is good practice, but not particularly gallant. The Ithuriel started to sink, and I then know what you did when a ship sank, which is you go down below and shore up like mad. We were aided by, in fact, almost saved by the French Fire Brigade, who arrived alongside with their wonderful brass helmets and proceeded to try to pump the sea back into the sea, but without much success. The ship slowly but surely sank, and it was realized it would be a bad thing for it to sink actually alongside. So we were towed out, and she finally settled at the entrance, off the entrance to the harbor, together with all my gear. Not quite all my gear, I still had uniform, and because I had been actually, the ship was sunk when I was at action stations, I had sort of basic kit. Anyway, the ship sank, and I was then put ashore in Bern, which was horrible because there was no navy there. The place was run by the army. We had the balls blown off us day and night, and we were spare hands, so we were invited to go and shoot paratroopers who allegedly had landed outside Bern. It was a real chaos. So I stuck two nights of that, and then, thank God, the force came back into the harbour. And as the force secured alongside, I raced aboard the first ship I saw and said, did they have a berth for a midshipman? This was a destroyer called the Quentin. And I saw the captain, and the captain said, if I were you, admit I'd join us tomorrow morning, because he knew we were going to go out on operations. And I said, quite honestly, no matter what, it'll be better than being having the ball blown off me in Bern. So he said, all right, if you want to, be aboard by 4 o'clock. So I joined at 4 o'clock with no kit. I mean, myself, I think by then I managed to collect a razor, that was about all, and a cap. And I was allocated to an action station, and we sailed at 4, and we were in action against an Axis convoy at 6, and we wiped up the whole convoy. It was a really exciting night. We were in operation from about 6 until about 2 in the morning, and we sank all the escorts, and then went around and sank the whole of the convoy.
How big was that, John?
Oh, there were about 8 or 9 ships. I mean, it was all reported and so on. Great Allied victory. And of course, the poor bugger, we went in so close that you could see the poor bugger jumping off the side that you were firing. And one could fire the gun, look around, see whether you hit or not. And we invariably did. Anyway, at 2 a.m. I turned in by being told where to sleep. And at 6 the following morning, there's a familiar bang, and the Quentin was hit by a torpedo just the other side of my bulkhead. So by that time, I was becoming a bit of an old hand with this stuff. But of course, I didn't know anyway. and the officers, and they didn't, I met them just before we went to action, but they, but I would don't suppose I made any impression on them at all. And I didn't know any of the sailors. And I duly got hold of about four or five sailors and started shoring up the bulkhead the other side of my cabin. After I broke my way out of my cabin, because I, being hit the other side, the deck had risen and the cabin door. But I left the cabin in some hurry, so I just had a pair of underpants and my cap. I thought they'd wear a cap or something to show where I'd come from. Anyway, I started with about eight sailors, and we were shoring up the bulkhead in good form and holding the bulkhead pretty well. And I noticed that my working party got smaller and smaller. When it was down to myself,